This is a podcast from 3RRR 102.7 FM in Melbourne, truly independent community radio. Hello and welcome to the September edition of Right Now Radio. We're here with Ben Shockman and Evelyn Tadros, and I'm Rachel Ball, and we've got a really exciting podcast for you today.
We do indeed. Well, other than having three of us all in the studio at once, which is exciting in itself. Hi there, Ev.
Hi.
We have a great show lined up. We're speaking with Anthony Lowenstein, the author of Prophets of Doom.
There was a fun little interview that Emily Howie from the Human Rights Law Centre and I did on Saturday night around Emily's kitchen table, and we talked to him about his new book, Prophets of Doom, and also an extract from that book, which is up on the Right Now website, about Christmas Island immigration detention.
Taking Right Now Radio to kitchen tables near you, which is great. We also have a brand new segment on Right Now Radio, which we're launching on this episode called The Gist of It.
Guess what it is about?
Well, I don't know, but why don't we get Hugh Crossthwaite into the studio so that he can give us the gist of it about
Stucky,
the gist of it?
That was a really easy question. It's about the gist.
Okay. Well, stay tuned to find out a little bit more about what actually is the gist of it. And we're also having a chat with you, Ev, about various human rights projects and events around Melbourne.
That's right. There's a lot of exciting things happening in the next couple months.
And as usual, we get the Right Now wrap, all the latest that's happening on the Right Now website. So stay tuned for that.
I want them one day to do the Right Now wrap to the tune of the Wham rap. That's just what I'd like.
So when you think Right Now wrap, does it have a W in front of the
not
rap?
In my or mind.
Not
in
I don't know. So actually, right. We should ask them next time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do it
so
in rap
stay
form.
Tuned for that. But before we get into our action-packed show, let's have a quick chat about the current political context. It's election time. How much are we hearing about social justice issues, I guess, is the big question that we're going to have a quick chat about. Guys?
Well, there's a few biggies on the agenda. Obviously, refugee policy, where the major parties are both dredging the depths of murky swamp of...
It's definitely not being talked about.
You haven't finished that sentence yet, Rachel.
I don't want to.
It's definitely not being talked about in a human rights context. Let's put it that way.
No, well, they do just interestingly come out and say, and these policies are compliant with international law. And, you know, case closed.
Yeah, indeed.
But we have a case that says that it's not.
Yeah, so also in the last couple of weeks, the UN Human Rights Committee has issued views on a complaint that was put to it in relation to a group of refugees with adverse security assessments and their family members who were locked up in immigration detention indefinitely. And the UN Human Rights Committee decided that was a violation of a number of human rights under international law, including the right to be free from arbitrary detention and the prohibition of torture, cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment.
And someone asked me how many human rights violations were found.
Well,
according
do you
to Twitter, over 150.
That's
over
right. 150.
But I think it was there were 46 asylum seekers about whom there had been found violations of the ICCPR by Australia, but multiple violations. So it really does add up.
Yeah. I don't think that this would have been surprising for people. I mean, this issue has been in the media quite a bit. This group of people who are in this darkly bizarre scenario where they've had these adverse decisions made against them, they don't know the reasons, they're not able to challenge them, and they're facing a lifetime in detention as a result. You know, it can come as no surprise that this is a violation of international human rights.
Absolutely. And maybe just before we finish our quick wrap-up, let's have a quick chat about a debate which didn't get quite as much attention, but the debate between the Attorneys General that took place earlier in this week.
Yeah.
Rachel,
so did you guys... Yeah, I had a look at some of the... I mean, they talked about a few different issues. A couple jumped out at me. For regular listeners, you'll know that a little bit crazy about anti-discrimination law, and they had a chat about the current Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus's commitment to consolidating the laws if they get back into government. There was some argy-bargy about whether anti-discrimination laws are social engineering, which is one of the all-time most frustrating conversations. but yeah, let's not go into that. The other issue that I thought was really interesting that came up in that debate was around the role of community legal centres doing advocacy, with George Brandis saying that when people have pressing legal needs, it's not appropriate for a community legal centre to advocate around systemic reform, completely ignoring the fact that often that is the most efficient and effective way of addressing their legal needs, you know, to fix the problem at its source rather than churn through hundreds and hundreds of clients with the exact same legal problem.
And maybe just the final election issue to mention, Ev, paid parental leave, which has been getting a lot of attention by both parties. That's the signature election commitment from the coalition, and kind of hilarious to see Labor's counter to that, to say that it's a scheme.
A waste of money.
That's too generous.
That's right, too generous. And I think it seems that the Liberal Party are, you know, very passionate about this issue. As Abbott says, he's a convert to it, so he's got the convert's zeal. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is something that's actually divided a lot of people in terms of whether it's a good scheme or not, whether it's too generous or not generous enough. Should maternity leave be considered just like any other leave entitlement, like sick leave or that type of thing?
You're listening to Right Now Radio, and that's been a little wrap-up of human rights news over the past month. Coming up after this little musical interlude, Rachel and Emily Howie are chatting with Anthony Lowenstein. Stay tuned for that.
Hi, we're with Anthony Lowenstein, who's an independent author and journalist based in Sydney, and who's got a very interesting new book called...
Prophets of Doom.
Hmm. Hi, Ant.
Hi.
Hi, Ant.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Right Now Radio.
Rapt to be here.
Welcome to Emily Howie's kitchen table.
Homespun journalism, yes.
So, Ant, can you tell us a little bit about your new book, Prophets of Doom?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically the idea for it was to argue that in the last 30 years the corporation has become more powerful than the state. So I'm not the first person to say that, but looking at how in areas such as war, detention centres, resources, mining, aid, there's been a shift in the last 30 years in much of the West, and this is bipartisan, it doesn't really matter who's in power in Canberra, London, Washington, it's almost irrelevant. That in all these sort of areas, the public is sold an argument that the private interests are far more efficient and cheaper. And all the areas I've examined, I spent time in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Haiti, PNG and Australia, you find in countless examples, in fact, the opposite is true, that a lack of accountability and less transparency is the result of outsourcing. And particularly when you're dealing with, say, war or locals in PNG or detention centres, asylum seekers, it's actually the worst way to manage human beings.
And up on the Right Now website at the moment is an extract from the first chapter from your book, which discusses your trip to the Curtin Detention Centre.
Yeah.
Everyone can have a look at that extract by going to the Right Now website, which is rightnow.org.au. But Ant, can you tell us a little bit about that trip and what you saw when you went out into the desert?
One of the things that most people might not realise is that the Australian government and the Immigration Department make it very difficult for journalists to access detention centres. So, and the reason I think that Australia has placed main detention centres in remote areas is for a very good reason, because they don't want easy access by the public or the media. And, of course, if you can't humanise asylum seekers, then it's much easier to demonise them and say that they're queue jumpers or taking our jobs or whatever it may be, the rhetoric that you hear from both sides of politics and indeed much of the corporate press. So Curtin is about 2 hours from Broome. It is in the middle of nowhere. It's in the Kimberley. It is an old RAF base. It is now run by Serco, which is a British multinational that runs all the detention centres in Australia, in the mainland and Christmas Island. When I was there, and still now, they're roughly, it's only men, male asylum seekers from, I guess, the countries where most people are coming from, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran. And you can imagine when you have 1,000 men in a very tight situation with not much to do, inevitably there'll be tension and problems. So I spent time there visiting, I stayed at a town called Derby, which is about half an hour away, a very poor pretty depressing town where there's massive Indigenous issues in terms of housing problems and alcoholism and all these. What you find when you go there is it's almost like the Australian government's made a decision to not really spend much money assisting a local town, but they're spending countless millions on a detention centre down the road. And you visit there and you see, let's say I spent time with various asylum seekers, but also with quite a few of the guards as well.
Yep.
And I think one of the things the book taught me, amongst many, many other things, was my own, challenging my own, I guess you'd say, prejudice against people who work in prisons or who are guards or managers of these centres. I think the perception often is that they can be cruel, inhumane and do awful things, and yes, that of course is partly true, but the system brutalises and corporatises them as well, to the point where many of them are thrown into these situations in, say, a desert, where they're getting a decent salary but they get virtually no training. So yeah, you know, something that the detention centre in Curtin or Christmas Island, and you see people on your first day who are trying to cut themselves or hang themselves.
But is the problem here that the prison or the detention centre is privatised? I mean, isn't the problem that they're in a remote location, so that even if they were run by government, it would be difficult for there to be good accountability for what goes on in these places?
You're absolutely right. The issue is not just privatisation, that's very true. I think the issue is that we have mandatory detention, people are held indefinitely, typically obviously if there's a failure of ASIO findings as well, so people, as we know, can be kept, and they are kept indefinitely in various states of distress. But yes, I think the issue is that, you know, first isolation, be a system between the government and a private corporation which allows both sides to blame the other when something goes wrong, and when you're trying to find out information, as a lot of journalists do, one side blames the other and the other side blames the other. So it's a sort of constant cycle. But yes, to me, that, and the countries that have outsourced their detention centres, particularly Britain and Australia, I think is using Britain as a model, unfortunately, because Serco and G4S, the other major British multinational, has a lot of influence in the UK as well, are so experienced in gathering contracts that I think the Australian government has made the decision on both sides that it's seen as far too expensive to put it back in public hands, to put the centres in. Well, assuming you have centres at all, in the centre of a city. I mean, obviously there are centres in Sydney and Melbourne and Perth and Darwin, but a lot of the worst ones are the most remote ones. And I think that one of the real issues, I think, also that I found, and I was on Christmas Island after that, is it's partly the isolation, and it's the sense that people are left almost, not to rot, but there's a lack of concern for the community locally as well, that the government has sort of dumped these people almost in the middle of nowhere. So yes, putting them in public hands in, say, Curtin would not solve all the problems at all. I think there'd be different issues and different problems. And also, I don't romanticise the public sector. I'm not saying that by definition the public sector is ideal or utopian. It's not. But I think that it's much easier for accountability in that system than when it's privatised.
Do you think that obviously there's a whole range of reasons that the government is so committed to mandatory detention of asylum seekers, and even though they're telling the community at the moment that the asylum seekers will be sent to another country, they're still building more detention centres onshore, as they say that. Is there a link between that and the power that's in the hands of the corporations that run the detention centres, do you think?
I think it definitely is. One of the things you found during the Howard years, and many people who used to work for the private companies back then, they said it during the Howard years, but they said it more when Rudd came in 2007, was that there were countless examples of Woomera and elsewhere in the worst years during the Howard era where managers from private detention centre companies would deliberately tell staff to not manage a situation, to allow it to get out of control, to allow riots to happen. And that's an obvious, very cynical way of managing a situation, because then Company X goes to a government and says, this is out of control, we need more money, we need more support, we need more backing. And this was provided almost indefinitely, and there's evidence for that, and I put that in the book. during Labor's opposition until 2007, Tony Burke, amongst many others, Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd, talked about saying that the idea of having detention centres in private hands was insane. For-profit companies should never... I mean, all these records, all these comments are so blatant now in hindsight. Mm. 2007 happens and, of course, it was stayed and kept in public private hands. 2009, Serco, the British multinational, won the contract. Back then, it was about $370 million contract, which was relatively small for a relatively few number of people. Fast forward now 4 years, second half of 2013, and there are roughly 10,000 people in some form of detention in Australia. The contract that Serco has is roughly $1.86 billion plus.
Mm. And so what's going to happen with PNG? Do we know that yet?
We do. I mean, what's happening in PNG is that G4S, the British multinational, runs the centre there, if you can call it a centre.
At Manus.
People may have recalled recently that there was a pretty damning report on SBS Dateline from a former G4S manager alleging serious assaults, mm-hmm. rapes between men of detainees that people were essentially turning a blind eye to, the authorities, Immigration Department, G4S. The expansion of a centre at Manus will benefit both G4S and various other providers. And I'm not saying that the centres are being expanded because of company pressure or lobbying. Of course, it doesn't quite work that way. And I'm not saying that in the last 4 years, although Serco's contract now is far bigger, mm. they have no control over, you know, boats coming or going. I'm not arguing that. But having said that, and I have in my book and a lot of Serco sources who say that as far as they're concerned, they can't handle the contract, but they're loving it. I mean, their bottom line is massively increased.
Yep.
It's their biggest contract in the world, even though they're a huge multinational.
In the world?
It's their biggest single contract in the world, yeah. They have a range of contracts which are worth hundreds of millions, but it's now worth over $1 billion for one contract.
Mm.
The question is what happens after the election and whether what looks like to be an incoming Abbott government is able to certainly slow down boats. I mean, who knows? I guess we'll have to wait and see. But the effect of that is many people inside Serco are worried, so I'm told from Serco people, that they be having less people in detention and therefore earning less money.
Wow.
So how do they manage that? So the next way to look at it is they're going to try to find ways to... Community detention is something that Labor has done and the Liberals will talk about doing as well. So mm. to manage that, so to speak, which is a new way to get income. And this is the sort of... It's almost like a constantly evolving way to find new ways to raise revenue. And mm. the government's mm. pretty happy to provide that. It doesn't matter who's going to win in a few weeks. That'll continue.
Mm. Well, it's hard to end this one on a good note, isn't it?
What's the best thing that happened to you today, Anne?
Well, I've loved being in Melbourne. I was at the Writers' Festival today. Mm-hmm. It's in late August 2013. And I guess I really enjoy meeting... I met lots of kind of random people, a lot of people. I met a lot of lawyers, actually, today, young lawyers who are disillusioned with the law, who want to be journalists. And I said, don't do that. That's not
going to happen. It sounds like you have so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I mean, it's one of the things that I've found amazing. This has been a privilege in my life is I travel a lot and I meet a lot of people I would never have expected to meet from all different walks of life. I guess journalists often have that door that can open in a way for you. And certainly I think certain kinds of journalists more so than others, ones who are not embedded. I think I've often written that embedding journalism is not just a physical thing, it's also psychological, I think, as well, that so many mm-hmm. journalists choose and make a choice that you want to be close to power and be an insider. And I think most journalists and journalism for that reason is mostly insular and useless, and emails are read a press release, and you could be an outsider who sometimes throws stones from the outside and has contacts on the inside, as I do, and certain people I admire do as well, but you choose that kind of journalism. You don't earn as much money, but that's why.
No, but you write some really interesting stuff, and I haven't finished Prophets of Doom yet, but one of the things I'm really liking about it is that you go through a whole lot of familiar areas, sort of human rights issues, but it's a different angle, it's a different way of looking at the way the machine works, and it's a really important aspect of understanding why the things that are happening happen, and you know, connected to that is how we stop them happening. So
yes.
It's a really valuable book, I think. So
thank you.
Thanks.
I guess I wanted to say just finally, just before we finish, that one of the things that it was also important to me was to not just write a book or a lot of my work, which is simply saying things are broken.
Mm-hmm.
And in many areas, you know, if you write about human rights or wars in Afghanistan. I was there last year. You go there, you can't sort of walk away feeling hopeful. I mean, you'd be delusional. But there's also things that there are people who are resisting and providing alternative ways, and I think it's important. I don't think it's a journalist's role necessarily to sort of provide like a three-step method to improve the world. I mean, other people can do that.
What about a six-point plan?
A six-point plan would be great. Or a 10-point plan or whatever. But I think, you know, it was important for me to provide examples and individuals who, I guess, often, you know, inspired me in these places. People, you know, mostly no one's ever actually really heard of.
Mm.
And or groups, especially, you know, when you go to somewhere like Afghanistan, it's hard to find light there,
and,
really.
And what was the light you found in Afghanistan?
I think if we choose to listen, that there are a lot of local communities doing a lot of amazing work.
Mm.
I mean, the country was destroyed before we got there in 2001, and we're going to leave, most of the West will leave next year by end of 2014, and we're going to leave a country where it's even more broken. And I think Australia and other countries that have occupied it for 12 years have a responsibility to demilitarise the country but provide other kind of support, but aid that is not directed at foreign contractors but at local communities and groups that are doing good work.
Yeah.
That's the problem with so much aid, which I talk about, which I won't go into, but that so much aid that the West gives is not going to local communities in countries, it's going to Western contractors who are earning a fortune, and they can do some good work. But too often I think when those people get pulled out, what exactly is left? And I saw that in Haiti and Afghanistan, that a lot of these organisations and NGOs, I think many on the left and the progressive side of politics sort of idealised that world, the NGO aid world, and it does amazing work in so many cases. I'm not here to suggest that it's all destructive, that's obviously not true. But there's not enough, I think, critical thought about where the aid goes and how contracting works, and are we actually, as a Western countries or NGOs, empowering local communities? Because when we pull out, as I said, I see that in Haiti, the country is little different from before so much of the West, particularly the US, went in there, and I think that model needs to be challenged, which it too rarely is.
Well, it's fantastic to have your book out there. That's challenging that model and providing that really important contribution.
And I found this book was a bestseller, so I'm pretty happy about that. I just found that.
Oh, congratulations.
Really, like on the business books bestseller list, which is so weird.
Well, can I say that this episode of Right Now Radio is probably really going to bump up sales.
Can you tell our
listeners where they can go to get a copy if they're interested?
Of course. People can buy it at bookshops. You can go to the website profitsofdoombook.com. It's available as a physical book. It's available as an e-book. It's on Amazon.
Where can't you get Profits of
Doom? You can get it basically everywhere. At a bookshop near you.
Thanks very much, Anne.
Thanks, you.
Anne. Thanks, Emily, too.
Thank you, Rachel Ball.
That was Rachel Ball and Emily Howie speaking with Anthony Lowenstein.
Thanks, Anthony.
Indeed. So make sure you stay tuned and check out the Right Now website, where you can hear, or you can read, in fact, his article that'll be posted very shortly. You're listening to Right Now Radio here on Triple R. Joining us in the studio now is Hugh Crosthwaite. And as foreshadowed at the beginning of the show, Hugh, we baited all of our listeners with the idea that we've got a brand new segment for Right Now Radio, the gist of it, and you're here to give us the gist of it about the gist of it.
That's right. It's brand new insofar as it's only 4 years old.
Indeed. So first of all, welcome to Right Now Radio. And why don't you start by giving us a bit of background about what actually is the gist of it?
The gist of it started as a website with web videos that would be very short and that would cover a major topic that were information about which was a necessary precondition, in our view, to understanding political discourse.
So political discourse, human rights more broadly, political discourse?
Well, as it started, political discourse, so for instance, we did an episode about the Constitution so that people would understand how the Australian Constitution worked, and then when they heard people talking in the media and the press about how the Constitution worked or about how some policy might interact with the Constitution, they would understand that background. And obviously that's very important to human rights, because human rights enforcement and human rights in action is often linked to legal procedures and political procedures. If you don't understand the system behind those actions, then it gets very difficult to voice your opinion, and it gets very difficult to engage with the way policy and the values of our society move and progress and change.
Now, coming up in just a moment, we're going to have the inaugural gist of it, which is Sarah Joseph from the Kasten Centre for Human Rights Law telling us all about the ICCPR in 1 to 2 minutes. You've just mentioned the Constitution. What are some of the other topics that you've covered previously in your project, Hugh?
Well, at the time, water was a very big issue, so we went and had a chat with a fellow from the CSIRO about water. He was their like top water guy. We had a look
water
at,
boy. Did you?
Yeah, he was the water boy. Now he was actually he was a really nice guy, and he was very generous with us. And that was one of the probably Evelyn, you were there. That was probably one of the most enlightening and interesting because it was an area that I certainly didn't know anything about.
Definitely,
it certainly changed the way I viewed that discourse at the time. And we did an episode on the separation of powers with Malcolm Fraser. That was great, explaining the basis to the constitutional system of government in this country. We did human rights with Jeffrey Robertson. We covered everything. It was all there. It still is there online.
And former High Court Justice Kirby as well.
Yeah, we talked to him about the justice system and you know how the courts work.
Well, you've set a very high bar for us with some of those experts providing insights on issues. Have you got any views on how difficult it can be, I guess, to try and distill what are quite often quite complicated or nuanced topics or arguments into a really short piece? I mean, 1 to 2 minutes, it's not long.
Yeah, the difficulty we had, it was always in editing, you know, because people would say these gems and they would say all this stuff that was fabulous, but you just wouldn't have time to put it in. But look, I think in the finish, in the end, a lot of these ideas are pretty straightforward. A lot of them are pretty common sense as well. But it's understanding that terminology, it's understanding the way that a system has been built out of an idea, and then, you know, you have other say policy advancement that comes from that system. So it still carries the values, but it might not be obvious to the naked eye what those values are. I think often it's actually easier than it looks.
I think the important thing also about being able to distill those ideas into short 2 minute stints is that it becomes more accessible for people, and a wider number of people are able to actually understand these concepts, which are so necessary to understand, as you said, political discourse
and human rights more broadly. They're meant to be broadly accessible and apply to everyone within the community. Everyone within the community, therefore, should be able to understand a lot of the concepts.
Absolutely. And, you know, at the base, particularly with human rights, at the base of human rights discussions and human rights advancement are principles and ideas that are very common sense, you know, like they're not difficult ideas to understand. You know, the idea that people would have well-being and people would be happy and not live in misery and suffering, I mean, it's not rocket science.
Now, you mentioned your project earlier. Where can people, if they're interested in finding out a bit more about it, find all the information here?
The Gist of It has a website at www.thegistofit.com.au. There's some videos up there with some materials as well, some written materials that you can download. Presumably from here on in, though, the first place you'd go is the Right Now Radio homepage.
Oh, we should have Hugh on the program more often. Good one. Well, with that in mind, a big thanks to you for coming in to talk to us about The Gist of It.
That was my pleasure. I'm glad you're doing it.
And let's get into hearing from Sarah Joseph with the inaugural The Gist of It. Inaugural. It's a funny word, isn't it? Here it is.
The Gist of It, a double shot of vital human rights information from the experts themselves.
Today I'm here to talk about the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, otherwise known as the ICCPR. The ICCPR stems from the Universal Declaration on Human Rights from 1948, which was adopted in the wake of the atrocities of World War II. The international community came together to agree on a universal set of human rights norms. The Universal Declaration was translated into treaty form in 1966 into two treaties, of which the ICCPR is one. The other one is known as the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. The ICCPR, as its name suggests, protects and recognises civil and political rights. These include rights of autonomy and personal integrity. So rights, for example, of physical autonomy, things like freedom of movement, the right to privacy, freedom from arbitrary detention, and at the most extreme end, the right to life and freedom from torture. It also recognises rights of spiritual and mental autonomy and integrity, such as freedom of expression and freedom of religion, conscience and belief. The ICCPR recognises rights to be treated fairly, so things like a right to a fair trial, or more broadly, freedom from discrimination on irrelevant grounds. It also recognises political rights, things like the right to vote and to stand for election. But you need more than that. You also need rights to ensure that one's participation is meaningful. So there has to be freedom of assembly so people can demonstrate, freedom of association so people can join interest groups and political parties, and freedom of expression so that ideas, including political ideas, can flourish. These days, the ICCPR is binding on 167 states, including Australia. That's the majority of states in the world, and it really is one of the most important human rights treaties in the world today.
And thanks very much to Sarah Joseph for the inaugural The Gist of It on the ICCPR. Now, for all those human rights geeks out there, Sarah Joseph, together with Melissa Kasten, have just released the latest edition of their International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights textbook, Cases, Materials and Commentary. That's available through Oxford University Press, so check that out. So thanks, and make sure you stay tuned for more segments of The Gist of Us on the next Right Now Radio episodes. You're listening to Triple R.
Time now for one of our favourite segments on Right Now Radio. It's when we get to catch up with Evelyn about all of the news and events that's happening around Australia in terms of human rights. So what have you got in store for us this month, Ev?
Well, I wanted to just focus on human rights projects and events that are coming up, particularly those that give voice to those who are marginalised, disadvantaged or vulnerable. And there have been quite a few very interesting projects that have caught my eye. One which is very relevant to right now, it's the topic of the month, homelessness, and it's a great project that has been launched by the Public Interest Law Clearinghouse Homeless Persons Legal Clinic, and it's called In the Public Eye, and it's basically six personal accounts of what it's like to be homeless and caught up in the fine system. And they've done a really great job with six people who have experienced firsthand being homeless and what it's like to get fines for public offences like begging or fines for public transport offences, and how that has impacted their lives. And what they're basically calling for is for council workers and ticket inspectors to be supported to stop and think before issuing fines to those who are experiencing homelessness, for the basic reason that what's the point? You know, they don't have any money to pay anyway. And it was a great launch that I attended. The Attorney General, Victorian Attorney General, attended as well. And we heard directly from those who were involved from the project. So make sure you go check that out. That is actually on the Pilch website. It's www.pilch.org.au/HPLC/ in the public eye, and you can get a real insight into what it's like to be homeless and have an overwhelming number of fines. Another project that has struck my eye, and which I'm quite excited about because I'm going to see the production tomorrow, it's a production by Somebody's Daughter Theatre Company, and that's a company that works with people who are marginalised or vulnerable, particularly those who are in prisons or are in the parole system, and works with them to develop theatre productions or art exhibitions about their own personal stories. So I'll be heading to the women's prison tomorrow to see that production, and hopefully I can have a chat to someone there about the development and how it works. As I understand it, the women get together and actually write the play based on their own stories and perform it, and also sing and play music in it as well. So it should be...
So hopefully we'll be able to hear a bit more about that next...
Yeah, should be really great.
October.
And the last event that I wanted to just alert people's attention to, it's the opening night of the Melbourne Festival, which is coming up in October. And what I'm quite excited about with the Melbourne Festival this year is they've got a real focus on Indigenous events and really trying to celebrate our Indigenous culture, particularly in Melbourne. So while a lot of events, you know, they have their Welcome to the Country, but it can feel a little bit token at times, this Welcome to Country is actually a huge event, and it's a free event down at Federation Square, and it's being facilitated by Ilzbejeri Theatre Company, sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly, and they're bringing elders from five Kulin nations to open the 2013 Melbourne Festival, and it's going to be a three-year kind of event where they come together every year for the Welcome to Country and really celebrate, Victoria and Melbourne as their heritage, and celebrate that with everyone else in Melbourne. So make sure you get along to all those events, and I think they'll be fantastic.
They sound really great. Ev. Thanks very much for the update, Ev. And the first two projects in particular, Rach, I guess, feeds in a lot with the work that you've been doing around the use of storytelling in human rights advocacy and how important it is to really both empower individuals and facilitate them to be able to tell their own stories as well.
Yeah. And I was at that launch, the Homeless Persons Legal Clinic project, with Ev as well. And it's so clear, you know, when you're sitting there and you're listening to people explain what happened to them, it's so hard to come back with any reasonable justification of the way our fine system works at the moment, because you just see so starkly how pointless and unfair the whole thing is.
Well, one of the interesting things for me was, the Attorney General talking about how the system has become a lot more automated. So there isn't really human intervention along the way. And I felt, by contrast, what this project was trying to do was really show the human face behind the consequences of giving people these fines. So,
and they're not they're asking for a bit of common sense, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. And it gave a good argument in support of that asker, I thought.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thanks very much, Ev. You're listening to Right Now Radio here on Triple R. It's time now for the Right Now Wrap, where we take a look at what's happening on the Right Now website. And this month we have Rose from Right Now giving us all the latest on what's been happening. Over to you, Rose.
Hi, I'm Rose. This month at Right Now we've taken an in-depth look at homelessness in Australia. The statistics on this subject are alarming. According to the 2011 census, over 100,000 Australians were homeless on any given night. Though when we talk about homelessness in Australia, we're not only talking about the conventional idea or stereotype of what it means to be homeless. As Tony Birch writes in his essay, "We All Need a Roof in the Rain," the predominant face of the homeless has been male, the middle-aged or elder wino, who is both the recipient of our pity and a figure of danger. But the truth is, the nature of homelessness is multifaceted, and a variety of Australians will experience homelessness in many different ways. Sienna Merope, for instance, takes us to Darwin, where each night around 1,000 longgrassers, slang for Darwin's homeless population, sleep outside, often in parks with no shelter, having to contend with the Northern Territory's rough monsoonal rains and the ever-present threat of violence, a fact of life when you are vulnerable without personal security. But reducing Indigenous homelessness is a challenge, not just for NT policymakers, but also for this country as a whole. Chloe Potvin demonstrates this point as well in her article on the rates of homelessness among female Indigenous prisoners. Indigenous women are the most overrepresented and constitute the fastest growing group in Australian prisons. But what's more, once they serve their time, a number of these women have nowhere to live when they return to the community. Indigenous women prisoners are the least likely of all prisoner groups to access housing and support services on their release. We also have an article on the connection between homelessness and family violence. Many women, particularly single mothers, often with young children in tow, become homeless after fleeing domestic violence or abusive relationships. There is evidence that suggests that in order to reduce homelessness in Australia, we also need to reduce the problem of family violence too. And then there is the matter of what happens once a person ceases to be homeless, after they finally attain stable accommodation. Is that the end of the story? In A House is Just a Home, Carolyn Nunn tells a tale of Ben and Tracy, once homeless, who are now in possession of their own houses. But just because they are no longer sleeping rough, doesn't mean they are no longer in need of support. For many former homeless, a house is just one tiny part of what they actually need, having been bruised and shaped by their homelessness experience. For these Australians, finding accommodation is just one step in their journey to rebuild their lives. To read Carolyn Nunn's article and all of the other articles I've mentioned, head to www.rightnow.org.au.
Well, I think that's it for September podcast.
It's all over, September podcast.
Already? It's not even September.
I know. Oh. Well.
Oh, yes, it will be. Sorry, it is. In the future.
Ev just forgot Stop that we're
recording
this a few days earlier. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in to Right Now Radio. Make sure you check out the Right Now website. I think we've given that plenty of plugs throughout the show, but jump online. And tell a friend about Right Now Radio.
Yeah, we have actually discovered in the course of recording this podcast that we have two listeners.
We're and really
I can't
fans.
Tell you how excited we all are.
At least. Two
at least, yeah.
Plus all of you out there.
Hi to both of you out there.
So thank you to all of you out there. Thanks to Rachel and Ev.
Thanks to you, Stocky.
Yay. And as always, check out, or if we want any feedback, so drop an email to radio@rightnow.org.au if there's anything that you like, you don't like, particular issues you might want to hear about.
Just boost our egos a bit. Tell us how much you love listening to us, I think.
Sounds like a good plan. Stay tuned for our next episode in a month's time. And in the meantime, bye for now.
This has been a podcast from 3RRR 102.7 FM in Melbourne. Truly independent community radio. Want to hear more? Check out our website at rrr.org.au.